Today is Tuesday, June 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, 1 week after his death, the family of George Floyd hold a vigil at the site of where it happened and plead for demonstrators to be nonviolent.
The question will become an issue of premeditation. If the prosecutors can determine that the way the officer pushed his knee against Mr. Floyd's throat, that may itself be sufficient for premeditation, you can get first degree.
As people across the U.S. take to the streets, an alarming number of journalists are being targeted. Also ahead, the music world is planning to respond with silence. It's all on today's International Edition. Monday marked 1 week since the death of a black man killed by a white police officer, which has since triggered mass demonstrations and chaos on the streets across America, far beyond just the city of Minneapolis where it started. George Floyd's family held a vigil as his brother Terrence Floyd, in a tearful plea, called for justice through action but not with violence, which he said will not make it better or bring his brother back.
They think we're going to do this. They think we're going to do something, and we're going to switch it on them.
That's right.
Let's switch it up, y'all. Let's switch it up. Do this peacefully.
That site has now been filled with flowers, photos, and messages. Also on Monday, Floyd's family attorney announced the conclusion of an independent autopsy confirming that his death was homicide by asphyxiation, contradicting the original medical examiner's autopsy, which was inconclusive and said that there were possible contributing factors to Floyd's death. But two doctors who carried out the independent autopsy and attorneys for the family said that Floyd had no underlying health conditions. Joining us now to talk more about this from Minneapolis is criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. Jack, what do you make of all this?
It's a huge deal. The original autopsy actually said asphyxiation was not the cause of death. That means if you're prosecuting this case, you're going to use that second autopsy, which actually may support amending charges. At the same time, if you're on the defense, if you're representing this officer, you're going to use that very first autopsy and you're going to show his cause of death had nothing to do with what this officer did. So this actually makes it more complicated.
How can it be denied that this man was on tape, shown, pleading for his life, begging for the officer to stop, that he couldn't breathe, crying for his mother? Wouldn't that be pretty strong evidence right there to be consistent with the autopsy saying that he was, in fact, unable to breathe and asphyxiated?
Oh, there's no question about it. But if we think about what the medical examiner decided to do and what evidence the medical examiner decided to use, I think that's the distinction in this case. Because what the medical examiner did in the first place was to look at the body itself and to say, based upon the body that's in front of me, if I move forward with an autopsy, will the body itself tell me anything? The problem, of course, is that the final answer, that it wasn't asphyxiation in the first place, that it was asphyxiation in the second place, will be something that's used as tools by both sides. Look, I've been on both sides of these kinds of issues, and you use what's in front of you, and I guarantee both sides are looking at this, scratching their head, saying, okay, I got to find a way to make that one sound good and make that one sound bad, and you decide which is which.
And you mentioned that the charges could be potentially changed, and the attorney for the family in a news conference Monday said just that this was intentional and that it should be changed to first-degree murder, not third-degree, given that this man had his knee on George Floyd's neck, and it was concluded by this autopsy that he, in fact, died in that position.
It's important because when we look at the cause of death, it changes how you can charge this. The question will become an issue of premeditation. If the prosecutors can determine that the way the officer moved, the way the officer pushed his knee against Mr. Floyd's throat, that may itself be sufficient for premeditation, you can get first degree. On the other hand, if you can't get premeditation, I think what it also does is it now supports a second degree murder charge. And the difference between second and third degree murder in Minnesota is dramatic. It could be in excess of double the amount of time that one might serve in custody as a result. So this is a very big shift and something that the Attorney General's office, who is now involved in the prosecution, will certainly use to their benefit.
What about the other two officers that were seen in a later video also involved, and they were restraining him?
We're not done yet, because what I think is coming next is the possibility of amending charges in the first place on the first officer. But there's three other officers that are out there, and they could actually be charged as accessories. And so I think the first step here, the first decision is going to be made on what those original charges should be for the officer in question, and whether or not this is going to be a second degree charge or a first degree charge. Honestly, when I looked at this, when I saw the video, what I thought in my head was second degree murder, intentional, and specifically second degree intentional murder. And then I started thinking about charging the other officers as accessories. The question is how do you use that? Because remember, this is about pressuring those officers to provide testimony in support of the prosecution of the major officer. And I think that's how the prosecutors will be looking at a case like this.
And because you're in Minnesota, you know the players, and you know that this case has now been turned over to the state attorney general, Keith Ellison. What implications do you think that has?
I think it's a big deal, too. And I think it's important for the community itself. The African-American community has really felt abandoned in many ways before this incident. I think that's part of what's driven it. But if we look at what's happened and how this was treated in the first place, the fact that it wasn't charged for days, when in fact, I think there were a lot of us who looked at this and said, I could charge this based upon the video that I watched. So I think that we have Keith Ellison, former Congressman Ellison, who's the attorney general in Minnesota, African-American, Muslim, is looking at this case and stepping forward. I think that gives a lot of people some confidence. There are others in the community who may look at this the other direction and say, oh, wait a second, is this become something very political now? So you're going to see that fight, just like we were talking about with the autopsy. You're going to see this as a fight that could be used on one side or the other to make political hay. If you can make it legal hay, might be harder. But I think putting Attorney General Keith Ellison in charge of this investigation and prosecution is a great idea. First of all, I think we can be more confident that there's going to be a fair trial for all sides involved, and that it's going to be less political, not more political, because that's a big part of this too. And I think for a lot of people here in Minnesota and really across.
Criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. Well, the comments by Floyd's brother earlier on Monday seemed in stark contrast to President Trump in a conference call Monday with most of the nation's governors. He berated them as weak for not cracking down harder on lawlessness that has gripped cities from coast to coast. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
President Trump is demanding governors do more to crack down on violent demonstrations nationwide. The president ripped into state leaders during a video conference, saying most of you are weak and making themselves look like fools for not calling up more National Guard to, in his words, dominate the streets.
Governors across the country must act. Deploy the National Guard as it's fit.
White House spokeswoman Kayleigh McEnany noting the Pentagon says just a fraction of National Guard members available have been deployed amid some of the nation's worst racial unrest since 1968. The Secret Service rushed the president into a White House bunker Friday night as protesters gathered outside. He's told advisors he worries about his safety. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Later in the day, Trump made a brief statement saying he is a law and order president and called for stepped up police action.
The following measures are going into effect immediately. First, we are ending the riots and lawlessness that has spread throughout our country. We will end it now. Today, I have strongly recommended to every governor to deploy the National Guard in sufficient numbers that we dominate the streets.
Trump did not mention the simmering angst of despair over racial inequality and frustration that has only been made worse in the midst of a pandemic. Likely Democratic Party presidential nominee Joe Biden responded to what's been happening, saying the nation has to overcome its latent racism. AP correspondent Tim McGuire has that story.
Former Vice President Joe Biden says George Floyd's death while being knelt on by a white Minneapolis police officer once again exposes the nation's open wound of racism.
None of us can any longer can we hear the words, I can't breathe, and do nothing.
While not mentioning him by name, Biden condemned President Trump's tweet, when the looting starts, the shooting starts.
This is no time for incendiary tweets. It's no time to encourage violence. This is a national crisis. We need real leadership right now.
Biden is also calling for what he calls real police reform that holds all cops up to the high standards that so many of them actually meet. I'm Tim McGuire.
As peaceful And some chaotic protests continue across the United States and many cities put in place curfews. There is increasing concern about journalists being targeted by police with rubber bullets, tear gas, and arrests as they cover the demonstrations. President Trump has blamed the protests on the so-called, quote, lamestream media. Joining us now to talk more about what is happening with the free press is Dr. Courtney Radge, Advocacy Director with the Committee to Protect Journalists. Thank you so much for being with us. I know you're monitoring all of this very closely. First, just a reaction on what you are seeing.
We are pretty shocked by what we're seeing around the country as police seem to have been targeting journalists as they have been cracking down on protests around the country. It's really shocking to see police arresting journalists who have identified themselves as such, and as well as putting them into really dangerous situations, firing rubber bullets, firing tear gas, and essentially refusing to allow the press to do their job safely.
Why do you think this is happening? This is not really something we have seen in the United States. We've seen this in other places. Why do you think it's happening now?
So actually, I think that we have seen this in the United States at protests. We know that journalists are often put in really dangerous situations, both by police. For example, remember the Ferguson protests, the Standing Rock protest in 2016, Occupy Wall Street. And they're also caught up, you know, in the protesters who are angry and not always happy with how the media are portraying the protests. So what we see is protests are flashpoints for attacks on journalists. But what is new is that the scale of these protests are nationwide. And it does seem that there are anecdotal reports of police who are actually targeting journalists. You know, we've seen some of these on live TV, and that is the real shocker.
I'm seeing the headline to a Reuters article that says open season on the free press. Granted, yes, journalists are always putting their lives at risk when they are covering serious things like this. But I think, yes, like you said, the magnitude of this is just sort of stunning to see journalists standing there, I'm the press, and being put in handcuffs and not just getting injured in the midst of it or even appearing to be directly targeted, but actually being arrested for reporting.
It is shocking to see journalists who've been arrested, including while live on air reporting. We've seen this in several states throughout the country. So this is not just the CNN journalists who are arrested, but it's really problematic as well that after we even heard an apology from the governor, that we still saw anti-press violence by police forces there. What's really concerning is journalists who are reporting that they identify themselves as journalists and were still attacked. It seems like the police don't care and that is offering no protection. So one of the things that the Committee to Protect Journalists has done is put out some updated safety advice for any journalists who are covering these protests. Also remembering that we are still in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic and there are some serious health risks as well to covering these protests.
Dr. Courtney Radge, Advocacy Director with the Committee to Protect Journalists. Well, the death of George Floyd and the chaos that has ensued is being closely watched on the world. There have been a number of protests in cities across Europe. Joining us now for more on that part of the story is Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, what can you tell us?
There's been a range of demonstrations right across Europe and Dublin, the Irish capital, protests for a third day there on Monday, rallies in front of the United States Embassy there. We've had demonstrations in the German capital, Berlin, and also here in Paris. Just in the last few hours, we've had demonstrations there out front of the American Embassy in the center of Paris. Now, these demonstrations are quite small. That is really because we've got so many constrictions on size of demonstrations, the gatherings of people because of coronavirus. So they are not normally allowed to have more than 10 people gathering in one place, but you have been seeing these much larger demonstrations. And of course, in London, where there is meant to be a restriction on the number of people who can gather, you had thousands of people out on the streets in front of the American Embassy for 6 hours on Sunday, demonstrating against this. They were waving placards that shouted, "No justice, no peace." Some others just had on their placards, how many more. Police didn't stop them, but eventually, once it did get to the American embassy, the area was surrounded by police. And after many hours, people did go away. Also in Denmark, outside the US embassy there, participants were carrying placards. And one of the messages just said, stop killing black people. This is something that has really touched a core of Europeans.
The protests themselves, the demonstrations that were happening in Europe, were peaceful?
For the most part, they were very peaceful. This isn't an anti-government rally of the types we usually see in Paris, large ones with agitators. Really, what we're just seeing is people just wanting to express their indignation. And it hasn't just been on the streets. We've also had sports people, such as soccer stars, particularly in matches over the weekend in Germany. Some have kneeled, others have worn T-shirts in support of the case of George Floyd. It's right across the spectrum, and they've just been very peaceful demonstrations.
And what about leaders in Europe, Paris, Germany, and so forth? Have they said anything about what they've seen?
It's been very quiet. There's been, if you like, a sense of disquiet, as well as a sense of inevitability. Everyone's seen the problems that America has been facing with trying to get on top of the coronavirus, trying to get on top of this pandemic. But it's been a bit subdued, simply because Europe is somewhat self-obsessed at the moment by its economic revival program it's bringing in to counter the economic effects of the coronavirus. But there's also been, in lots of ways, a sort of, when I say inevitability, because there has been this gradual drip, drip of bad news coming from America, and particularly the American President Donald Trump, his retreating from international agreements, his disdain for any type of international organization, this whole feeling that this was just a president who was controlling just an elite. This feeling of that here in Europe, really, it hasn't surprised a lot of people that it's come to this.
And it's interesting because the G7 was sort of uncertain because of the coronavirus. And then just recently, about a week or so ago, President Trump called on G7 leaders to have it at the U.S. and to come in June. And now it looks like he has again called that off and wanted to include Russia.
To be honest, there was relief among the European members of the G7 that it looks like the G7 Washington summit has been postponed. Certainly, even just talk of President Trump making a new format as to what any subsequent meeting would look like is of great concern, because you have to remember that Russian President Vladimir Putin and Russia was expelled from what was then the Group of Eight, the leading industrialized nations, in early 2014 because of Russia's annexation of Crimea. Russia is still annexing Crimea. It is still present. Even more so, though, the United Kingdom is also a member of the G7, was very unhappy at the thought of Russia being invited, because think back, 2018 in the UK, they blamed Russia for the poisoning of a former Russian double agent in southern England. So
Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Well, the protests have pushed much of the attention away from the ongoing pandemic in the United States, but health officials say there will likely be a new surge in cases due to the ongoing mass demonstrations. As the global coronavirus pandemic impacts economies around the world, there are questions as to how China-Africa relations will be affected and if China will respond to requests for debt relief from African countries. VOA's Salem Solomon spoke to China-Africa experts and files this report.
China is Africa's largest trading partner with over $200 billion in combined imports and exports annually. China has also financed billions of dollars of infrastructure projects like roads, ports, and railroads across Africa. The COVID-19 crisis is hindering African countries' ability to repay debt and decreasing China's willingness to invest abroad. Yan Sun is the director of the China program at the Stimson Center. She says China's role in African financing will change as China grapples with economic recovery from COVID-19.
The Chinese economy is taking heavy hit from COVID-19 as well. That's inevitably going to dampen the Chinese ability to disburse financing or continue to support infrastructure projects in developing countries, including Africa, at a rate that it did before.
One of the biggest questions is the future of China's numerous infrastructure projects, including the massive Belt and Road Initiative. The Chinese government, banks, and private investors lent about $146 billion to African countries between 2000 and 2017. Due to COVID-19, many of the world's chief lenders are calling for a pause in payments or debt forgiveness.
So it's not just one African country who is welcoming this global gesture or this global calling for debt relief. But I would say that the picture looks very different from the Chinese side. That first off, given the massive amount of debt that the African countries owe China, whether it is financially feasible for China to forgive those debt is a key question here.
It is estimated that African countries owe a combined $44 billion to service debt this year. Leading global lenders have agreed to pause debt service payments from poor countries. China has said it's open to the idea, but prefers to negotiate terms with individual countries.
The Chinese attitude towards that to begin with is quite resistant. It doesn't mean that China will not engage in, for example, debt renegotiation or debt restructuring or even postponement to offer longer grace period for the African countries to pay back their debt. But I think a blanket debt forgiveness is not in the cards to begin with.
Hannah Ryder runs a business consultancy based in Beijing. She says many African leaders believe taking a debt is essential to building the national infrastructure to jumpstart economies and lift citizens out of poverty.
It's never great to have debt. But the reason why African leaders have decided to go into debt to fund different infrastructure projects, to fund, you know, energy, roads, etc., is because those are badly needed on the continent.
Ryder says China is one of the G20 countries that has agreed to cut debt servicing costs to 77 poor countries, freeing up an average of $260 million per country this year.
There are going to be some infrastructure projects that will go bust, that won't be working as a result of COVID-19. And those issues need to be looked at in a much more kind of detailed structural way.
But concerns remain as to how China will react to an inability by African countries to repay loans in the long term. Salim Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
Here are some of the other stories we're following at VOA. China's state media and the government of Hong Kong lashed out on Sunday at U.S. President Donald Trump's vow to end Hong Kong's special status if Beijing imposes new national security laws on the city, which is bracing for fresh protests. Trump on Friday pledged to take action to revoke Hong Kong's preferential treatment as a separate customs and travel territory and to impose sanctions on unspecified individuals over Beijing's new laws on the Asian financial center. Australia's three decades of uninterrupted prosperity are coming to an abrupt end as the global coronavirus pandemic crashes one of its most lucrative sources of income, immigration. The country has been successful in managing the outbreak and reopening its economy, thanks in part to an early closure of its borders. And officials across the southern part of the U.S. are still scrambling to adjust their hurricane plans to the coronavirus. The big question remains how to deal with social distancing if temporary shelters are needed. Hurricane season has officially started, and forecasters are expecting a busier than normal season. Stay with VOA for all the latest U.S. and world news. The mystery surrounding a mass die-off of elephants in Botswana is deepening after initial test results ruled out poisoning and anthrax. Wildlife officials had earlier ruled out poaching as no ivory had been taken. But officers have discovered more carcasses as the death toll surpasses 100. Mukdisi Dubey reports from Gaborone.
Wildlife officer Tikamatso Nsebe said initial results have ruled out anthrax and poisoning as the cause of death. Samples would now be sent to neighboring South Africa for further tests. He said more animals could die as some look sickly.
We are still experiencing elephants dying in the Okavango Panhandle. We also see elephants that show that they are sick and are in the verge of dying. As of Friday, we had a total count of 110 elephant carcasses.
Villagers have been warned against consuming meat from the dead animals. Nsebe said the public has thus far heeded the call. The Department of Wildlife has begun removing tusks from the carcasses.
We have started removing the tusks in those dead elephants, and we have started burning the carcasses. We have started with those that are close to the villages and those that are lying in the water. The idea is to burn as many carcasses as possible. However, we have a challenge since some of the carcasses are in areas that are difficult to reach with a vehicle.
The department is also investigating the cause of the elephant deaths. The search is complicated by the COVID-19 crisis, which may delay results from the samples. The COVID-19 disease is caused by the coronavirus. Botswana has the world's largest elephant population at more than 130,000. Mqondisi Dube for VOA News, Gaborone.
Since the COVID-19 outbreak, Ghanaians have traveled to a plant research center outside the capital, Accra, to give scientists and researchers herbal products and plants they think will help cure the coronavirus, or at least alleviate symptoms. About 70% of Ghanaians depend on herbal remedies for their health care. Last year, government hospitals began integrating the practitioners and training them to incorporate scientific methods into their work. Stacey Knott reports.
The Center for Plant Medicine Research grew out of a visit by a Ghanaian doctor to China in the 1960s to learn from Chinese herbal medicine. The center's acting executive director, Kofi Bobby Barama, dreams of finding a cure for COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus that came from China. And he's not the only one. Some people come to the center located in a lush, mountainous area in Ghana's eastern region, claiming they have a cure for the virus revealed to them in a dream.
What we've told them is that it's good that it's been revealed to you, but at the Center for Plant Medicine Research, what we do is that we do research to look at the safety of it and then also to make sure that it's something that can be consumed by the public, and we also make sure that it's something that is plant-based.
In the labs of the center, researchers have been testing local herbal products to see what might help in Ghana's fight against COVID-19. So far, they have recommended herbal products to boost immunity. But the center is also testing and planning trials of herbal medicines against the virus, scientist Alfred Mpoma Apia says.
Herbs have what we call phytonutrients or phytoconstituents. And when we use these herbs, they have a broad activity that helps the whole human. It contributes to health a lot.
Ghanaians' belief in traditional plant-based medicine is widespread. The center grows medicinal plants to help with a range of diseases and conditions, including malaria, typhoid, and high blood pressure, Michael Ofori, a technologist at the center, says.
Our forefathers were using these herbs long before we were born, but they didn't have the scientific means to research and know the actual dosage of the plant. Now we are being privileged to have that technology at hand. So then we have to then attach that technology to the herbal aspects that can be very safe for us to consume.
In a town close to the center, trader Abena Oye says she relies on herbal remedies and hopes Ghana will find a traditional cure for COVID-19. She says it would make them happy because the illness is something that is worrying us. All our finances are messed up, says Oye. The whole world is a mess. So if the medicine comes, she says, we will be very happy and we will take it and it will help us and Ghana will be held in high esteem. That is also the ultimate goal of Ghana's Center for Plant Medicine Research. But any treatment, they say, must rely on scientific evidence, not just dreams. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Akuapim Mampong, Ghana.
And finally, the music industry today is planning to turn off the music and hold a day to reflect and implement change in response to the death of George Floyd, as well as the killing of other African Americans. Well, top record labels organized the blackout. Also, Live Nation, TikTok, and The Recording Academy will participate in the effort to support and stand with the Black community. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Wunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you for listening. Take care and be well. We don't need to escalate. See?